There is also a world of thought out there that you don't trust the artist, you trust the tale. And that you could say that George unconsciously was making a film about racism because it was 1968.
Yep.
And the fact that Martin Luther King died just as they were going to release it, the light bulb went on for them and they knew what they'd made.
Horror Movie Survival Guide is a weekly podcast where I, Gorehound Julia Marchesi, delves into my horror movie notebook to corrupt another one of my longtime chums, Terry Gamble, who is hiding in the creepy horror closet.
My mission is to learn the gospel of horror movie survival and to incorporate Julia's wealth of wisdom to become a final girl disciple.
Join us as we take a deep dive into everything from OG horror
to newly released films,
but prefer the classics on VHS.
We'll talk about obscure details that no one else notices.
Spin off into alternate casting universes, crush on some dodgy, foxy fellows,
and creepy uncles, and arm ourselves with the knowledge necessary to become the final girl.
Hey guys, welcome to Horror Movie Survival Guide. I'm so excited. We are excited because we have the amazing guest on today. We have Michael Dougherty. He is a horror genius, I'm going to say, because he's also worked with one of our favorite horror geniuses, George Romero. So we're going to talk with him about that. Michael, welcome so much to the show today.
Hello. Thank you. It's great to meet you guys.
Thank you. We're so excited to have you here. We are in the middle of doing a George Romero round on our show, so this is perfect timing for us. But before we get to Mr. Romero, we're going to talk about you a little bit because we want to know about the first horror movie you can remember watching.
Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte.
Ooh, an obscure choice. Talk about how that happened.
Yeah.
Our family used to go camping in Upper New York State, and occasionally at these campgrounds, they would have movies playing at night. And that was one of the ones. I was a kid. I was probably 10, and it scared the hell out of me.
Oh, my God. Yeah. At 10? Yeah. Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. And then were you? Yeah, go on.
The same question, Terry. You could say it just as well as I. Please, go ahead.
No. I just was wondering, I lost my question now. Go on. Okay. You, Julia. No,
the question great. The question we were both going to ask is, did that make you love horror afterwards, or did you stay away from it for a while and be like, ooh, not into it?
I saw a few horror films growing up, but it was actually never really the first genre that I was enamored with. I mean, there was so many other films. The thing that drew me into the business in the first place was films like 2001 and Zabriskie Point by Michelangelo Antonioni, sure. Amarcord by Federico Fellini. And the thing that worked for all of them was the way that music helped to create the feelings that you had when you were watching it, mm-hmm. particularly the end of Zabriskie Point with
That sequence is amazing.
Yeah, and Pink Floyd's version of Careful With That Axe, Eugene. In 2001, just the use of the temp score that became the real score for the film. And
so well done. Yeah. And my body right now just like sense memory of that, like what that feels like in a cinema and everything. It's so, so overwhelming and wonderful.
But the other thing too that I learned from that film was that you can watch it silent and the A story is all there. The main story about evolution was told not in dialogue, but through pictures. The B story with the HAL computer, you know, the dialogue helped to tell that story. But the whole thing, if watched silent, you still get the movie.
Sure.
And that's pretty amazing. And it's one of the things that I do when I'm editing. I just turn off all the sound, even the dialogue, and I'll just watch to see how the pictures cut together. And particularly with horror films, you're creating an atmosphere, and part of the atmosphere just comes sometimes just from a slow, stealthy camera. Audiences are anticipating things, and you can play off that anticipation. And so I like to just see how things work without any sound at all.
That's so smart. I love that. I'm like my slack jawed. Like, that's such a basic thing to think about, but that's so brilliant. Yeah.
So can I ask how come you didn't get into the music end of filmmaking, that you can be, you know, someone who's in charge of the music in the film, if it sounds like it's such a big part of what you enjoy about filmmaking?
Well, I mean, when I was, I actually originally got a degree in commerce from Concordia in Montreal.
Interesting.
And while I was doing my commerce degree, it was a quite an open-ended program. It allowed me to take a lot of other courses at the same time. So I took astronomy, theology, film, music, psychology. And when I graduated, I knew that I never really wanted to work for somebody else. And I didn't want to be working in an office scenario with 2 weeks holiday, 3 weeks holiday a year. So I spent in the next sort of year and a half at loose ends. I traveled around quite a bit. And I just made a list of six things in my life that I liked. And I picked the one that I thought I'd have as much fun learning as making money at. And the course that I remembered being the most intrigued by was the film course that I took. It was more of a film history course, but it introduced me to a lot of different films. And I just decided that I wanted to get into that business of creating the kinds of emotions and things that had always affected me. And so I went back to school and I got a degree in film and electronic music, mostly film.
Okay, well, you got music in there too, though.
Yeah, that's great.
So I have a massive collection of soundtracks that I listen to.
Do you have a favorite soundtrack?
What's the favorite soundtrack? Yes.
There's so many great ones, but I tend to go, I go for more for the atmospheric tracks. The music for the film The Fountain is great. Thomas Newman's music. I tend to go for a lot of maybe more melancholic styles, minor key pieces of music, so that or the piece of music at the end of A River Runs Through It when the man's fishing. It's just so evocative.
Yes.
And those are the emotions that are created that to me always had the most impact. You know, going back to Zariski Point, that wasn't so much the melancholy of it as the awe-inspiring of it. And the sense of awe that I get sometimes when I watch what filmmakers have done, even going back to Fellini's Amarcord, you know, it's a film that I took some friends to. And at the end of the film, they said, well, you know, we kind of like a film that has more of a story. And, you know, what I loved about the film is that it wasn't necessarily a story. It was these moments that Fellini and the composer Nino Rota created. There'd be a shot of a camera just panning through the piazza, and it was just to see the lights turn on. You know, it's
evoking
beautiful.
Evoking mood. I love stuff like that too, where it's just like, oh, that was a mood poem, you know?
Exactly. And that's what drew me into the business. So it wasn't necessarily horror, but I always was into the sci-fi genre. And to be perfectly honest, when I got the call to meet with George Romero, I mean, I'd of course heard of George and way back had seen Night of the Living Dead, but I hadn't followed his career. So on the morning of the interview, I watched Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead so that I could have them all in my head when I went into the interview.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, and watching them back to back is the way to do it, really.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about sci-fi a little bit, and you know, horror and sci-fi often cross over a little. So what I said, I know you said you didn't really start out, you know, it was more, and I know that George really had a very highbrow taste in film as well. So I'm sure you were able to connect on, you know, Fellini and these more, you know, well-known art filmmakers. But talk to us about some of your favorite horror films, and because there are a lot out there that are mood poems, right? You can have so many different kinds of horror.
I mean, it's a good question. I'd have to think about it. I mean, some of the more recent ones, I guess I saw a film, It.
Yep.
Which was really interesting.
Gorgeous.
I was a fan of Vincenzo Natali's work. Mm-hmm. Again, not really horror per se, but thought provoking. I worked with Vincenzo on a film called Haunter. Again, more sci-fi. You know, I watched The Ring, scared the hell out of me.
Yes.
That is so creepy.
So the ones that I'm most interested in are the ones that create that atmosphere, not necessarily the ones that are filled with jump scares, but that are more dread inducing. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the editor is really one of the most important person, people to work on film, and especially within horror film, because the editing is a lot of what makes a horror film scary. So how is editing a horror film different than a non-horror?
Well, like you say, I mean, the editor, you're creating tension, you're creating atmosphere, but you're also working very closely with sound designers, because a lot of what the horror films are about, it's the kind of anticipation that the sound might be able to evoke. And so when I'm working, I'm always putting in a full temporary soundtrack myself. So I have a library of a whole bunch of effects. And sometimes it's just a door squeak or anything like that, that you're creating anticipation in the viewer for something that may or may not come. I mean, I used to say to George, you know, and I'm sure he was aware of this anyway, but I would say, we don't have to pay everything off. You know, all you're doing is setting things up all the time. And sometimes it's nothing. Sometimes, I mean, one of the great moments in Survival of the Dead was when the young kid is going to fetch water from the stream and the bird flies overhead.
I was yelling at the screen the whole time while he was going out there. Yes.
But that's, again, it's a setup for something that you don't really pay off, but you kind of pay it off with the bird. And then when the bird goes by, everybody has this sigh of relief and they laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the great things about George's work is that he'll make you laugh at the same time as you're kind of worried about what might be coming next.
Well, what I was going to say is, I'm a big component of watching films in a cinema. I know is, you know, dodgy right now at the moment during pandemic and all, but once things get back to normal, and horror films are really the best to watch in a cinema with other people, because you can feel them being scared. And that moment that you talk about is one of my favorite things. I saw it 5 times in the theater, because the feeling of watching hundreds of people be scared, and then everybody has that moment where there is that laughter afterwards, because, oh, how stupid I was, I got scared by a bird, right? Like, you have this embarrassment going on with it, but it's a whole audience doing that, and it's such a wonderful feeling.
And I agree, when you can share that experience sometimes, but the worst time to watch it is at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're by yourself in a creepy house.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yep. Absolutely. I have a lot of movies that we watch for this show, obviously. And I'm like, that's a 6 a.m. in the morning when I'm just fresh waking up and the sunlight is coming in through my window movie versus a middle of the night, I don't want to be too scared of it movie.
I do remember one of the films when I was growing up that also scared me quite a bit was the original Black Christmas.
Yes, we just did a show about that last December, and it's so creepy. And you know, it's so crazy. You think Bob Clark did Black Christmas and A Christmas Story, and it's like these two iconic Christmas movies that couldn't be any further apart, and really one of the first slasher movies as well.
Yeah. I think they're both terrifying, though. I'm of the thought that they're both scary movies.
Christmas Story has its moments.
That Santa's terrifying. Yes, but also wonderful, like Canadian offerings too into the
era. That's right.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned getting in touch with George. So how did that meeting occur? How did you get introduced to him and recommended to him?
Well, what happened was, originally George, when he was doing Land of the Dead, was going to shoot it in Pittsburgh, where he had done all of his other films or his other zombie films. And they realized it was going to be too expensive to do it in Pittsburgh, and they decided to come to Toronto. He'd made Bruiser here in 2000, and they knew that they could probably, save 25% of the budget right off the top by coming to Toronto. And he had an editor that he'd worked with who was living in Los Angeles. And I think when they factored in the costs of his weekly salary, plus a per diem, plus hotel costs, plus flights back and forth to LA, they just thought it was going to become too much. And so George went to the Directors Guild, and it's interesting that just prior to his deciding to go there, they had asked editors to put together 8-minute demo reels. Mm-hmm. And George saw my demo reel, and he saw something in the demo reel that he liked. And it may simply have been that one of the scenes in my demo reel was a scene I had cut, just a simple dialogue scene with Dennis Hopper. And it wasn't flashy, but it was a scene sitting across a table. And I think George liked the fact that I included a dialogue scene just to show how people looked at each other, how they were reacting to what was being said in the dialogue scene. And so he asked the post-production supervisor to give me a call. And I received the call, I guess, I don't think it was a Tuesday afternoon, to meet the next day. And so I showed up having prepared myself to watch by watching his first three zombie films. And I went to the room at the hotel where I was supposed to be, and it was empty. I just walked in, sat down. And then about 10 minutes later, George walked in with the producers. His daughter was there. Peter Grunwald was there. The Atmosphere Entertainment guys were there. And George looked at me and he said, "So have you finished editing my film?" And I said,
"What?"
And I said, "In my head, it's all done." And he laughed. And I realized a long time later that the interview was never about whether or not I could edit. The interview was about whether George could spend 5 months in a room with me.
Yeah.
Yep.
And in many ways, that's what it comes down to when you're working as an editor. And I think, I don't know if the story is apocryphal or not, but I think that Universal initially didn't want me to edit because I wasn't on their roster. Mm. And neither was the DOP that George wanted. They negotiated to bring in the DOP from the second unit of Dawn of the Dead, Miroslav Bashak, who's a great DOP. And I think maybe the horse trading was that he could keep his editor if he acquiesced and gave them the DOP they wanted. And in some respects, it makes some sense. If you're not happy with the work of the DOP, you sometimes have to reshoot. But if you're not happy with the work of the editor, just fire them because the material is still the same.
Yeah, right? That's true. Mm-hmm.
And it worked out. I mean, George and I got along great. One of the things that, we both align ourselves politically the same way. And George, very kind of open hearted guy. We could just sit in the edit room, we'd be working, and then we'd just get into conversations about stuff, either politics or things happening in the world. And it really was a great working relationship. And I guess we spent from October until the following May working together. Wow. We had some pressure on us. The film was originally slated for a release just before Halloween, and we flew to LA to screen it for the executives at Universal in March. George was hoping to get some money to shoot a couple of additional scenes, and we screened it to the head of production. I'm not exactly sure of the title, but the guy who sat there watched the film, and when it was all over, he turned around and he looked at us and he said, "That was way better than I thought it was going to be," and which was great. And he gave George the money to do it. But we were under incredible pressure because they moved our release date up from Halloween to June 24th.
Oh, that's quite a jump.
Yeah. So we worked 7 days a week, and we had our screening in Pittsburgh, the first real screening. Which was really fun. Quentin Tarantino showed up and Robert Rodriguez showed up. They were big fans of George's, and it was wonderful of that. They also know Greg Nicotero.
Of course.
Because Greg had worked for both of them.
Right.
And I think he invited them to come along. And it was really fun to have those guys react positively to the film. And it just worked out really beautifully. I just think that maybe Universal putting us in between the release of Batman and War of the Worlds wasn't the greatest. I mean, we did well that weekend, but it's hard to compete with those big studio blockbuster films when you're trying
Halloween
to,
sounds like a better chance for
would
that.
Would have been, yeah.
Yeah.
But they had a slot, and that's where they put us. And, in the end, the film overall did okay. But, who knows how we would have done if it had been a later time.
So what was it like working with him? Because I know you, when you're with a director, they have, how much was he open to your input, or did he have a very specific vision that he was asking you to create for him?
No, he was very open. I mean, the way that it works is I come on board the day they start shooting. And so George is spending 2 months getting everything in the can, and I'm working, cutting scenes together as we go along. Mm-hmm. Occasionally I would send George, and I did this one of the scenes we shot right off the top was the scene at the drawbridge with Dead Reckoning. Mm-hmm. And I sent George that scene and the scene with Dead Reckoning driving through town and they're firing at zombies. And he really liked both of those. And so he was more comfortable at that point with me just going and working on my own, knowing that he was seeing stuff that he actually quite liked. When we were in the edit suite working together, he's very much open to ideas, but he sort of knows what he wants. He shoots things in a more classical style. There's not a lot of handheld camera. There's not a lot of swish pans or things like that. He tends to let the action take place on the screen for the camera. And we had enough coverage with a 2-month shoot to be able to try different things when we were in the edit suite. One of George's great strengths is the use of sound. He has only one working ear, and yet he hears everything. He lost hearing in one of his ears many, many years ago. And it's amazing because he's sort of very much in tune, and there'd never be a moment when there wasn't something going on. If there was a gap between lines of dialogue, George would say, okay, add a cricket. You know, if you're outside, put a cricket there. There was always something going on. And that's one of the things that I learned from George at the time was to really, really pay attention to that side of it. And for George, the sound was such a big part of the experience.
Sounds like you two have that in common.
Yeah. And he also liked the temp music that I picked, which also helped a lot.
So when you're an editor and you do that, I know I've had friends who editors, and basically what they've done is just like pick music they like and stick it in there as their temp thing. And then sometimes that gets picked up. Is that kind of your theory? It's like, you're just like, oh, there's a music I like. It fits here. It may not work, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, you have to be careful. You know, one of the things that I learned early on when I was editing is that you might like a piece of music, but if there's no way that the composer is going to be able to recreate it or a mood like it, I don't put it in. I'm not going to use any big John Williams score as temp music because no one's going to afford a 100-piece orchestra or 80-piece orchestra. So I don't do that. But I try to find a piece of music that fits the mood. And whether it's action, like when we were at the bridge, it was an action cue that I had used. And then other times I'll find much more melancholic music for, you know, when we did Diary of the Dead, you know, some of the characters along the way die, and we created the right mood for them. And our composer on that film, Norman Orenstein, was, you know, he captured those moods with his own score, different from what I had, but with the right mood. He even brought in a duduk, which is one of my favorite instruments.
I don't even know what that is. What is that?
It's a double reed instrument that's used Armenian music, Middle Eastern music. It's very plaintive and melancholic. And it was just beautifully used a couple of times in Diary. And there again, the example of having a piece of music that, for me, helps to elevate a scene, and to have your composers being able to pull it off is just great.
So you went, talk to me about how you became, because on A Diary of the Dead, you're associate producer. On Survival of the Dead, you're executive producer. So can you talk us through how these kind of bigger titles happen throughout this?
I mean, in some respects, it's with Diary, I was the post-production supervisor. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just a decision that George and Peter made to give me the associate producer credit because I had stuck with the film so far past the duties as editor and was really helping to pull all of the resources together to get the whole thing completed. And that's how I became an associate producer. It's not an uncommon title for some post-production supervisors. Most of the time, the post supervisors, it's their sole job on the film. In my case, I did it as well as editing. So that's where that one came about. And with survival, again, it may have been more about being a participant in the film right from the start, early on, rather than being brought on board on day one of shooting. I was there with George early on discussing possibilities for the project.
That must have been so exciting.
Yeah. So this is like you were in full on development mode with him.
Well, you know, when you're friends with somebody, because by then we were friends, that I would be hanging out with George. We'd go for dinners. I mean, part of the thing that helped cement the relationship in 2005, when we were promoting Land of the Dead, George was separating from his wife at the time, and Universal had provided him with two tickets to go overseas to promote Land in London, Paris, and Edinburgh. Oh. And George knew that he wasn't going to be able to go with his wife. So he asked me, and I said, thank you. Yes,
and yes, and triple yes. That's so cool.
So we hung out the whole time together. We were in Paris. We would laugh at the prices at the Dorchester Hotel. We'd have a gin and tonic for $21. Thank you very much. Oof. But it was, you know, that's what it cost when you're promoting a film. Universal was covering the cost of that. And that's where they put him up.
Get as many drinks as you want, right?
That's so nice.
But it was so fun because that was how George and I connected, because it was just the two of us. And we went out for dinners together. We were taken out by people in Paris, in London.
I want to know when the book is coming out where you write about this. This is your like, your travels with Charlie trip.
Just as an aside, I won't go too far into that, but I was a hitchhiker so much of time in my life. And every year I traveled to somewhere new once or twice on the planet. I've been to 52 countries so far, but I've kept a diary.
Wow.
I've kept a diary since January the 1st, 1983, and I write down what I do every day. And when I'm traveling and things happen that are unexpected or people that you meet, experiences, you have written them all out as stories.
That's amazing.
I'm obsessed with this. I can't wait to read it. When are you publishing this?
We will buy an advanced copy right now.
Both Julie and I are all about like that wanderlust lifestyle for sure. Like she's gone to so many countries too. I think her whole family goes on a crazy trip every year, usually to some random country for weeks on end, it feels like, and traveling around. And we met traveling Europe and like basically backpacking and going and spending a year abroad together. So we love that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about it is, and the thing I loved about hitchhiking was that you started at point A and you knew you were going to end up at point B, but you didn't know what was going to happen in between.
Yeah.
And it's the randomness of that that I liked.
I've seen too many horror movies to do it. Like I just can't. But I wish we lived in a safe world where that's possible. My ex-boyfriend lived in Japan and says in Japan, people do it all the time because it's totally safe.
And it, in fact, is still safe. People don't believe so because with the rise of cable news, part of what they need to do is to keep people interested. And the way to keep people interested is to scare them. I mean, that's one of the reasons why people go to movies, because they want to be scared. But they will report on these events that have a 1 in 1 million chance of happening. And they'll spend a lot of time on that 1 in 1 million thing. And so
if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And it's people isolated. Yeah.
And it's not the way the world is. I mean, there are obviously things going on that are not great in the world everywhere you go. But my experience being out there was that given the opportunity to be good, people will be good.
Oh, that's good to know. Absolutely. I guess, you know, Terry and I, you know, the whole theme of the show is horror movie survival guide, right? So it's how to survive horror movies as the final girl. And I've seen enough horror movies in my lifetime to be like, okay, hitchhiking, not going to happen. Camping, not going to happen. Like I've seen too many horror movies.
Done all of it. It's okay.
When you look back at this time and you think about how it influenced who you've become as an editor, how do you think that what kind of insight did George give you that lead on and live on?
I mean, one of the things from George I got was confidence. You know, when I first went in to work on Land of the Dead, I was a bit intimidated. You know, it's a universal picture. They don't know who I am. I have to prove myself. And George gave me a lot of positive feedback and made me feel like I actually was part of the team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I carried that forward. When you start building up a resume, when you start getting a name for yourself, people start calling, and that makes a big difference. The first film I ever edited, I positioned myself to be in the position where I could do it. I was living in Vancouver at the time, and I came through Toronto on my way to Madrid to visit a girlfriend. And I met a guy who offered me a job, and it was to operate the Avid editing system that he was going to buy. And I realized if I took that job, I could then talk to a guy I knew was making his first feature in Montreal, and I could edit the feature for free. And he took me up on the offer. I cut the feature for him. He liked it enough that he gave me three more movies to edit. And
he did a good job.
Well, that's the key, right? You can want to do something, but then once you get the opportunity to do it, you have to be good enough. And I guess I was good enough because I kept getting phone calls from people saying, come and do this film. It's what ended up leading me to the Romero world. And through that to doing Vincenzo Natali, I worked with Vincenzo a couple of times. I ended up working as an editor on the TV series Hannibal, in part, I think, because of the experience that I'd had with the horror films. And I had worked with the producer, Carol Dunn Trussell, before on a totally different series called Unnatural History. Mm-hmm. But she trusted my work and brought me on board with Brian Fuller's Hannibal project, which turned out to be just fantastic, if you ask me.
Can I ask how television and film editing are different?
The experience of editing is not that different because, you know, my job as an editor in collaboration with the director, producers, and the other members of the team is to direct the audience's experience of the story by choosing when to make an edit, when to go to a reaction shot, when to use your wide shot, when to go in your tight shot. You're creating the mood for the piece and you're directing the audience's attention by your edit decisions. So in television and film, that's the same. Now with film, you don't have to build act breaks. For network television, when we were doing Hannibal for NBC, you have to build in act breaks, and the writers have to write act breaks so that you're sort of leading the audience on at the end of an act to want to sit through the commercials and then come back.
Right.
You don't have to do that. There is an act structure, obviously, in feature films, but it's not defined by commercials. So that whole thing's changing, though, a little bit now with the streaming services. I've done a number of Netflix shows, and you are not limited by advertising breaks. So the structure is a little different. But in the end, editing for a structure or editing more freeform, in the end, it's kind of the same. You're still doing the same job, which is to tell the story as efficiently and as in an interesting way. That's kind of my job.
And so what are you working on now? What's coming up for you that you're excited about?
So I'm just about to start a project called Kings of Napa. I'm actually starting it on Tuesday. It's Warner Brothers, and it's for the Opera Network. And it's about...
Fancy. I don't know if Julia loves. I love Oprah. That's awesome.
I think it'll be a good series. It's the first season. So with... you know, what you're dealing with in a first season is the pilot is crucial because that's what's going to keep your audience interested. I also did 4 years on Wynonna Earp, was really, really fun. And, you know, it mixed a whole bunch of genres, including a little bit of horror. And I mean, the great thing about that show is it never took itself seriously. And a lot of the plot points were completely ridiculous, but the characters knew that what they were doing was completely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But what made the show work was that the relationships between the characters were always real. And that's the strength of a good showrunner. And Emily Andras, who was our showrunner on Winona Earp, knew exactly what she wanted her her world to be like. It's interesting in that one, if you look at the pilot for that show, the pilot's different from the rest of the show because we were still kind of figuring out what direction the show was going to go. Emily always had the big picture, but we weren't exactly sure what the main character's strengths were going to be. And we made a decision early on that we were going to tone down some of the sort of almost supernatural things that she was able to do. And because it wasn't, her strength wasn't going to come from that. Her strength was going to come from the fact that she was kind of insecure, didn't want to be back there, had a bit of a drinking problem, but was fiercely loyal to her family. And that is what worked for the next 4 years. And so, each project's a little bit different. I did another show called October Faction that was also kind of more horror about monster hunting. But the subtext in that series was racism. And I liked that the showrunners attempted to do something in that genre in this sort of the same way that George did over the years, which is that you have a particular genre you're working within, but the genre is really just the envelope around which you're trying to make a point, be it a point about racism or consumerism or class structure. That's always what made George's films the most interesting. And
we agree.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one thing that really drew me to his work and got me so excited is all the commentary.
And to that end, you know, the film that changed the most from the original intent was Diary of the Dead.
Okay.
Diary of the Dead was initially, it was these kids in the forest shooting this movie, college movie, on the night that the zombie quote-unquote apocalypse began. And so the kid decides to start training the camera on his friends as they negotiate their way back home. And the first idea was to have it as a series of long takes, 6-7 minute takes, as we detail what was going to happen. The problem is that once we got into the edit room, we realized that it wasn't actually going to hold together. Sometimes scenes would have been overwritten by George so that, and he said, he would himself would say that we don't need all this dialogue, and yet we're stuck to it if we have to keep this concept of the 8-minute take. Mm-hmm. So we abandoned that pretty quickly. And in order for us to create this sort of logic of editing, we decided that his girlfriend, Josh's girlfriend, was going to take this footage afterwards and edit to make a political statement about media. Now, George had always intended for that statement to be there because things would be going on behind the, you'd be seeing Josh holding the camera and one of his friends would get attacked and he'd still keep shooting it. He wouldn't help. And that's one of the commentaries and the whole concept of, we decided that it was more, it was also about Fox News deciding what the truth, their truth is for their audience, as opposed to whether or not it's the truth. You see it these days, obviously, with this perpetuating lie about the stolen election. They've decided that's their truth and they're going to, go to their grave with that as, I think it's awful, but it's the it's what happens. It's been going on in media
since media, correct.
go to Russia, go to Italy, everybody's got their
own. I lived in Russia for a little while and coming back to America, I'm just like, people, open your eyes. It's the same. Being fed.
Yeah. And it works on so many levels, not just the level of government propaganda or party propaganda, but advertising. Sure. Advertising is propaganda. All of
it. Yeah.
I'm a Canadian. I can't believe that every second ad you see on U.S. television is pharmaceutical.
Isn't it wild?
Trying to convince patients that they've got to go to their doctor as if the doctor doesn't know what to prescribe them. It's just insane. But that's the universe, you know, that's
been
created. The laws
are weird here. I know. It's so strange. I didn't realize how weird that was till I left and saw the difference in advertising in yeah. certain countries. And it's super wild. But
the thing about it, you know, George was never afraid to say these statements and pretty harshly as well, which I like about it, that he's just kind of saying, like, I see it. Do you see it? Like, let's all see it together. And I love mm-hmm. that, you know, and that every film, even going back, you know, to earlier stuff like Season of the Witch and Martin and stuff, like everything has this message underneath, you know, it's about
and the crazies zombies, of the
yeah.
government and like the government's yeah. going to come in and do what?
Yeah, exactly. And George would say that when they made Night of the Living Dead, that was not the intent. Mm-hmm. There is also a world of thought out there that you don't trust the artist, you trust the tale. And that you could say that George unconsciously was making a film about racism because it was 1968.
Yep. And
the fact that Martin Luther King died just as they were going to release it, the light bulb went on for them and they knew what they'd made. And George would say, perhaps we made it unconsciously. He would say that the actor that they had in the lead was just the best actor in the group. But it wasn't a coincidence that that actor gets shot by a Southern redneck. So you can't say, well, that was just coincidence. It was always part of what George was going to say. And it became, you know, the signature thing about his films was that there was always, he wouldn't make a film unless he had something that he wanted to say. He wasn't just going to make a film. You know, he would say Dawn of the Dead remake was kind of fun. He said good action movie, but it's not a George movie. Uh-huh. I mean, the closest thing, maybe The Walking Dead on television, you know, has elements of the George world. The fact that Greg Nicotero is on it says a lot. But there, you know, you watch some of the other films, Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later. It's a really great film, but it's not a George film. It may have zombies or it may have, you know, the equivalent, but they ended up deciding that it, the fast zombies made for scarier movie because it's a visceral scariness rather than a more intellectual scariness, which is what George was always after. The zombies were slow because it's the inexorable movement and change that you're not going to be able to stop no matter how hard you work at it. It's just not going to happen. And that's a kind of scary concept.
Sure. Well, I think something 28 Days Later and George have in common would be the distrust of the military. That's
correct.
In there.
Yeah.
We're like, the military happens to be the scariest people around, folks. You're hi.
It's fair. And George, we would get into a lot of discussions about the things that really got us angry. And the thing that got us angry in many cases, just injustice. Mm-hmm. And the fact that so many people are party to this. You know, again, going back to what the current state in the United States, I mean, what the hell are all these people doing, believing that this election was stolen? I mean, I don't understand it. It's so obvious that it wasn't stolen.
See, the thing is, though, Michael, everybody's got their own reality, right?
In like, a way just... to, yeah, you never know what someone else's perspective and justification. Like, we will justify anything for self-preservation. You know, and I think that's what it comes down to is like everyone in their own right wants to preserve their, you know, mode of thought or what they think is right in the world. And if they feel like that's an injustice, they've got to figure out a way to like fight against it. So it is really hard. And I feel like I, you know, feel like I grew up in the world full of people who believe in that perspective. So I feel like I understand it in some degree to why they need to hold on to that. But it's hard.
That polarization has been fostered to an enormous degree in the United States. And it's what Survival of the Dead was all about. Mm-hmm. I mean, that movie really was about two different people looking at the same thing and seeing it completely differently. And at the end of the film, they're looking at each other, firing their guns at each other. No one is going to compromise.
Right.
And that's, you know, at the time it was the Republican fight against Obama and Obamacare. Obamacare came along. It was a compromise because, you know, universal health care, which all the rest of the civilized world has, is not available to Americans. So Obama wanted to have universal health care. So he compromised and he picked the Republican plan. And the Republicans immediately rejected it because it was Obama's plan now, not their plan, which was, you know, in Romney had it in Massachusetts. Nixon had proposed a version of that back in the 70s. But because it was Obama, it's the enemy. And the problem with what's going on is everybody's the enemy. And that's what Survival of the Dead was about.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we are so waiting for your hitchhiking / road trip with Romero memoir.
It was so much fun. I can't wait.
And I just love that, like, I feel like survival and land also have, like, lots of hitchhiking elements when you're trying to survive an apocalypse. So I feel like even subconsciously, whether that was part of your contribution to the stories as well, I feel like that's inherent in that lifestyle. So it makes sense that you would work on all of these as well. Well,
the one difference, I guess, might be that if you're standing at a bridge and you're by yourself, you could get jumped on by a bunch of zombies. Whereas in my experience, I'd be standing at a bridge by myself. Some car would come along and pick me up and say, "Do you need a place to stay for the night?" And it would be a great experience, which has happened multiple times.
I love that. Michael, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
This is Horror Movie Survival Guide, and we always talk about survival. So before we let you go, we want to ask you a couple of quick questions. One, the big one is, how do you survive, I guess, a horror movie? Or what are your survival guide tip that you would want to offer to people, since you've also maybe hitchhiking guide tip, also horror movie survival guide tip? How about that today?
How would I survive a horror movie experience?
What tip would you give somebody? Yeah, what tip would you give someone to survive?
If you're by yourself and you're watching it late at night in a drafty house, close your eyes.
And if you were in the movie and you're in the apocalypse, what tip would you have to survive the zombie apocalypse?
I just turn the other way and run. I mean, you know, I mean, there's an inevitability to the zombie apocalypse that you're not going to be able to escape from. Right. But we do have the sense of self-preservation. I'd try to find a bunch of people, like in Shaun of the Dead, hole up in a pub.
Wait till the whole thing to blow over.
That's to the it. Winchester. All right. To the Winchester with you. Thank you again so much, Michael. We appreciate it. Thank you, listeners, for listening again today. We hope you enjoyed it. Check out all of Romero's films, please. We are so happy to share them with you and talk about them with you. You can check us out on all of our fabulous internet spots, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and our Patreon. We look forward to talking with you again real soon, and have a wonderful week.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thanks, guys.
It's very much a pleasure. Bye-bye.